The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article, What Happens When the U.S. Overestimates Its Power? By Phillips Payson O'Brien. Ever since a terror attack by Hamas triggered a war in Israel and Gaza in October, many commentators have presumed that the United States can in some way manage the course of the crisis, either by supporting Israel emphatically or by demanding greater restraint from that country's leaders. Successive American administrations, including Joe Biden's, have encouraged this belief in American control of events in the Middle East and around the world. Just days before the Hamas attack, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan boasted in an article in a Foreign Affairs article that the Biden administration had de-escalated crises in Gaza. The Middle East, he wrote, is quieter than it has been for decades. In essence, the United States had mistaken a temporary lull in the Middle East for a more enduring period of relative peace and ascribed the apparent boon to American influence. The lesson for the United States should be drawing is that it generally cannot enforce its will, however benevolent Americans believe it to be, in every area of the world. In region after region, the United States engages with movements and governments that are powerful actors themselves. Some will at least outwardly genuflect to the U.S., but all of them will pursue their own interests. In overestimating their own power, American presidents risk worse outcomes, both for the United States and for the causes it is trying to promote. As I have previously argued, the U.S. policy toward Ukraine has been bedeviled by indecision, poor calculation, and the presumption that the war will abide by American plans and expectations. Intimidated by Russian President Vladimir Putin's threats of nuclear war, the U.S. has delivered mostly short-range battlefield aid to Ukraine in the hope that such weaponry will be sufficient, while still denying the Ukrainians the ability to make supposedly rash moves, such as liberating Crimea from the Russian rule. Although the United States has gradually agreed to provide more modern equipment with greater capabilities, the delays have given Russia time to rebuild its forces and strengthen its defenses against Ukrainian counterattack. Supposedly great powers are usually anything but, as some of the world's mightiest, most resource-rich nations have demonstrated in a series of stumbles, failures, and even outright humiliations over the past few years. The full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022 is the most obvious example. Even with months to prepare for combat against a supposedly outgunned opponent, the Russians failed in a military operation of enormous interest to Putin. Nearly 2 years later, Ukraine remains independent. Although the invaders occupy significant territory, they lose personnel and equipment on a daily basis to a Ukrainian military armed with mostly older or limited-range weaponry from its NATO allies. China, the state that has transformed the global order more than any other in recent decades, is stumbling badly too. Only a few years ago, it seemed fully ascendant as it staked claims around its borders, expanded its influence through its Belt and Road Initiative, built the world's second most advanced military, and seemed poised to overtake the United States as the world's largest economy. Today, the Chinese economy is in a significant slump, and the regime faces hostile and worried neighbors along a crescent that runs for thousands of miles, from India through the South China Sea to Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan. Italy has signaled it will pull out of the Belt and Road Initiative. Sri Lanka, which is struggling to pay back Chinese loans that have yielded precious little economic benefit, is a cautionary tale for other nations about the potential dangers of Beijing's largesse. Recently, the Chinese government has been trying to patch up its relationship with the United States and persuade Americans to once again invest in China to allow the latter some time to recover. This rapprochement is not a sign that the U.S. has fared any better in great power politics. The extraordinary debacle in Afghanistan in 2021 suggests otherwise. After conducting the longest overseas military operation in American history, spending more than $2 trillion to fund the war and military occupation of Afghanistan since 2001, and suffering the deaths of thousands of American service members, the United States pulled out with what looked like little preparation. The U.S.-backed Afghan government collapsed far faster than the regime that the Soviet Union left behind when it pulled out of Afghanistan in the late 1980s. In seemingly no time, the Taliban, the regime that the U.S. had invaded to overthrow in 2001, was back in charge. After Russia invaded Ukraine last year, the U.S. seemed to regain its footing. Putin's invasion was so ill-considered and bloodthirsty, and Ukrainian resistance so fierce, adept, and determined, that Western nations felt energized and steadfast in their support for the invaded country. Yet in retrospect, the short-term boost to NATO's effectiveness seems like a lucky accident. American hesitation in the past year has helped make the war bloodier, longer, and potentially more escalatory than if Washington had simply picked a side and given it all the support necessary to win. Events in the Middle East are demonstrating the limits of Washington's power in other ways. The Biden administration is seeking to manage the Israeli response to the Hamas terror attacks of October 7th. Israel has shown a willingness to conduct an extensive bombing campaign in Gaza because the country's leaders perceive that to be in their country's interest, even though the U.S. is publicly urging it to act with greater military restraint. To preserve, even maximize its influence, a major power must understand what it can and cannot do, and in moments of uncertainty, err on the side of thinking that achieving its goals will be hard, not easy. The more assertive and interventionist a power becomes, the more likely it is to reveal the limits of its influence. The collapse of European colonial empires after World War II, America's defeat in Vietnam, and the fragmenting of the USSR in 1990 and 91 all show how even powers that seem strong and permanent can wither or disappear in a remarkably short amount of time. The U.S. should never be isolationist, nor should it define its global role, as it has so frequently done since the beginning of the Cold War, in terms of simply countering its perceived enemies. Instead, it should proceed cautiously in regions, such as the Middle East, where its record of recent interventions offers ample reason for humility. It should work to strengthen states, such as democracies in the Pacific Rim and in Europe, that emphatically want the U.S. to assist in their defense and security. Ukraine clearly wants to be in this group. American involvement should be seen as a prize, not a threat, and Ukraine's example helps clarify what kind of countries would most benefit from and deserve that help. Are they willing to fight for themselves? Are they governed based on the consent of their residents? The U.S. can engage in dialogue and seek areas of common interest with a variety of parties around the world, but it should use its power more judiciously than it has. By perpetuating the fiction that Washington can shape other countries' destiny on its own terms, the U.S. is undercutting its own global position. The author of this article is a professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Our second article today is from the science section and is entitled, An Exoplanet Discovery Akin to Finding an Ostrich Egg in a Chicken Coop. A very big planet orbiting a tiny star is challenging what scientists know about how planets form. And this was written by Servath Mahadevan, Gumunder Kari Stefansson, and Megan D. Lammer. Imagine you're a farmer searching for eggs in the chicken coop. But instead of a chicken egg, you find an ostrich egg, much larger than anything a chicken could lay. That's a little like how our team of astronomers felt when we discovered a massive planet, more than 13 times heavier than Earth, orbiting around a cool, dim red star, 9 times less massive than the Earth's sun, earlier this year. The smaller star, called an M star, is not only smaller than the sun in Earth's solar system, it's also 100 times less luminous. Such a star should not have the necessary amount of material in its planet-forming disk to birth such a massive planet. Over the past decade, our team designed and built a new instrument at Penn State University capable of detecting light from these dim, cool stars at wavelengths beyond the sensitivity of the human eye, in the near-infrared, where such cool stars emit most of their light. Attached to the 10-meter Hobby Eberle telescope in West Texas, our instrument, dubbed the Habitable Zone Planet Finder, can measure the subtle changes in a star's velocity as a planet gravitationally tugs on it. This technique, called the Doppler radial velocity technique, is great for detecting exoplanets. Exoplanet is a combination of the words extrasolar and planet, so the term applies to any planet-sized body in orbit around a star that isn't Earth's sun. Some 30 years ago, Doppler radial velocity observations enabled the discovery of 51 Pegasi b, the first known exoplanet orbiting a sun-like star. In the ensuing decades, astronomers like us have improved this technique. These more and more precise measurements have an important goal: to enable the discovery of rocky planets in habitable zones, or the regions around stars where liquid water can be sustained on the planetary surface. The Doppler technique doesn't yet have the capabilities to discover habitable zone planets the mass of the Earth around stars the size of the Sun. But the cool and dim M stars show a larger Doppler signature for an Earth-sized planet. The lower mass of the star leads to it getting tugged more by the orbiting planet, and the lower luminosity leads to a closer-in habitable zone and a shorter orbit, which also makes the planet easier to detect. Planets around these smaller stars were the planets our team designed the Habitable Zone Planet Finder to find. Yet our new discovery, published in the journal Science, of a massive planet orbiting closely around the cool, dim M star LHS 3154, the ostrich egg in the chicken coop, came as a real surprise. Planets form in disks composed of gas and dust. These disks pull together dust grains that grow into pebbles and eventually combine to form a solid planetary core. Once the core is formed, the planet can gravitationally pull in solid dust as well as surrounding gases such as hydrogen and helium. But it needs a lot of mass and materials to do this successfully. This way of forming planets is called core accretion. A star with as low a mass as LHS 3154, 9 times less massive than the sun, should have a correspondingly low mass planet forming disk. A typical disk around such a low mass star should simply not have enough solid materials or mass to be able to make a core heavy enough to create such a planet. From computer simulations our team conducted, we concluded that such a planet needs a disk at least 10 times more massive than is typically assumed from direct observations of planet-forming disks. A different planet formation theory, gravitational instability, where gas and dust in the disk undergo a direct collapse to form a planet, also struggles to explain the formation of such a planet without a very massive disk. Cool, dim M stars are the most common stars in our galaxy. In DC Comics lore, Superman's home world, Krypton, orbited an M dwarf star. Astronomers know from discoveries made with the Habitable habitable zone planet finder, and other instruments, that giant planets in close-in orbits around the most massive M-stars are at least 10 times rarer than those around Sun-like stars. And we know of no such massive planets in close orbits around the least massive M-stars until the discovery of the planet LHS-3154b. Understanding how planets form around our coolest neighbors will help us understand both how planets form in general and how rocky worlds around the most numerous types of stars form and evolve. This line of research could also help astronomers understand whether M-stars are capable of supporting life. Next, Life Really Is Better Without the Internet by Chris Moody. Before our first child was born last year, my wife and I often deliberated about the kind of parents we wanted to be and the kind we didn't. We watch families at restaurants sitting in silence, glued to their phones, barely taking their eyes off of screens between bites. We saw children paw at their parents, desperate to interact, only to be handed an iPad to keep quiet. We didn't want to live like that. We vowed to be present with one another at home and in public. We wanted our child to watch us paying attention to each other and to him. The reality after our son was born was quite different. In those sleep-deprived early days, I found myself resorting to my phone as a refuge from the chaos. I fell into some embarrassing middle-aged dad stereotypes. I developed a bizarre interest in forums about personal finance and vintage hats. I spent up to 4 hours a day looking at my phone while right in front of me was this new beautiful life, a baby we had dreamed about for years. My wife, Christina, felt abandoned in the isolation of new motherhood and complained of my near-constant phone use. "When you look at your phone," she told me, "it's as though you disappear. When it comes to having an unhealthy relationship with technology, I'm in good company." Most of us find that smartphones have made our lives better, but we struggle to use them in healthy ways. Nearly 60% of American adults told Gallup last year they use their phones too often. American adults spend an average of 4.5 hours on their phones each day, the research firm Insider Intelligence reported this summer. Almost all of us keep our smartphones within arm's reach during waking hours, Gallup found. Such easy and constant access to distraction is having an impact. Overuse harms our sleep and mental health. Constant distraction makes us less productive and can impair our ability to concentrate. Studies have shown that the mere presence of a smartphone can reduce our cognitive ability by taking attention away from other tasks, even if the phone is turned off. A majority of married couples report that their partner's divided attention has caused strife in their relationship. On a warm Saturday afternoon this past spring, I reached a breaking point. I had been on my phone for hours a day for the past several weeks. I found myself reaching for the phone whenever there was an opportunity or brief pause in parenting responsibilities. Was this what life was going to be like for the next 30 years? Days filled with a series of small interruptions while I scrolled for scraps of trivia and news. While our child napped that afternoon, I sat brooding on the porch. I told Christina that I wasn't happy with the way we were living and that I didn't know what to do to get back on track. "It sounds like we should get rid of the internet," she told me. I knew she was right. For years, we had discussed raising our child in a tech-light home, but because we had become so overwhelmed with parenting, that this priority had become pushed aside. We had tried half measures before, setting a timer on the Wi-Fi router that shut it off during evening hours, and making no phone zones in the house, but these were too easy to get around. To achieve what we truly wanted, a home that served as a sanctuary for meaningful family time without distractions, this was the step we needed to take. We talked about how spaces that were once off limits for technology seemed to dwindle by the day. Our national parks, public restrooms, even places of worship are now game for digital connection. We felt it was important to have at least one space in our lives that would be set apart. We agreed that our home, the only place where we still had control, would be a fine option. When, I asked. Now, she said. As millennials in the mid-1980s, my wife and I are part of the last generation to have known life before the introduction of widespread home internet access. We straddle both sides of the digital revolution. We remember answering the phone without knowing who was calling, showing up at a friend's house unannounced, what it was like to be lost and bored. In my 20s, I traveled across Europe, Latin America, and Asia for months without a phone, relying only on guidebooks and advice from strangers. I hitchhiked across across the American South with a flip phone. I did a stint on a commercial fishing crew in Alaska, which put me completely off the grid for 5 months without access to a phone or the internet. Christine and I had also gone off the grid together earlier in our marriage. In 2018, we moved into a 70-square-foot tiny house where we lived for 2 years, mostly on public lands and without Wi-Fi. In the wilderness, cellular data were limited, so we logged on only for essentials when we popped back into civilization. It was on the fringes of where we first tasted the joy of a life in which the internet was merely a tool. Without distractions, the days seemed to expand. We learned to harvest time, an idea that came to us in national forests across the U.S. We realized that days undisturbed by digital interruptions made time slow down and improve the quality of our time together. So yes, we'd had some practice with this before. Surely we could make it work. But we didn't need to plan. We live in a log cabin beyond the reach of cell towers in North Carolina's rural high country, and up to that point had relied on Wi-Fi to make phone calls. We might be crazy enough to cut our home off from the internet, but we didn't want to be completely disconnected. We were trying to relive the 90s, sure, but not the 1890s. Opting out of the internet would require us to opt in to a landline, which raised even more questions. If we needed to call a doctor, how would we find the phone number? What if we needed an emergency plumber? Turns out the Yellow Pages still exist. When the technician from the phone company arrived to put in our landline, I asked him, "Do you install many landlines these days?" "Mostly just for old people," he said. I told him we were doing it in hopes of making our lives simpler. He just nodded as if to say, "Sure, man, whatever." Soon the room filled with a sound I hadn't heard in ages, a dial tone. That long-forgotten but familiar pitch instantly brought me back to childhood, the anticipation of calling my best friend to ask if he wanted to come outside and play hockey in the street, or the nervous dread in middle school of calling a girl for the first time. You know, the technician said before walking out the door, most people just use Wi-Fi calling. I spent our final morning with internet service on a constant binge. I pulled up one final movie on Netflix, but it suddenly froze on our screen. The house went quiet. We were officially disconnected. Like any form of withdrawal, the first days offline required adjustment. With nowhere to scroll, I developed a voracious appetite for words. I loaded my nightstand with books from the library. I devoured them all and started reading anything I could get my hands on. Over time, the racing pace of a mind that has been hooked on content slowed down. I began to read deeply, sometimes for hours, consuming complex works that I would have struggled to focus on before. While reading news articles, I still felt an old tug to share links through social media, but now there was no one to share them with. I was reading purely for reading's sake, sharing an intimate moment with no one but the author. It made reading and thinking a private act, without any temptation to be performative in sharing my opinions. Reading through entire publications instead of finding stories through a social media algorithm that fed me a narrow range of content that it thought I would enjoy, exposed me to a broader range of opinions, viewpoints, and types of stories. It made me a better consumer of news. By the end of my first week, my phone reported that my screen time had plummeted by 80%. I had reclaimed several hours a day, time that I used to play games with my son, cook elaborate meals, engage in uninterrupted work, and take long walks with my family. Sometimes I just sat and thought, a radical act in our hustle culture. I daydreamed, letting my mind travel where it pleased with no agenda or direction. I realized that it had been years since I last allowed myself to do, well, nothing. Friends and family have responded with bewilderment and concerned amusement. I could never do that, people often tell us, but I wish I could. Other friends, knowing that our landline doesn't have caller ID, occasionally prank call us like they did when we were teenagers. When we weren't at home, callers seem amused to leave a real voice message on our answering machine. It's fun to listen to younger people leave messages. They are adorably befuddled by what to say. Of course, this also comes with trade-offs. One night while watching a DVD in our basement, Christine and I saw a dark object flash across the screen. Did a bird get into the house? I stood up to turn on a light and saw another flying object with wide black wings silently swoop past my head. It's a bat, Christina yelled. She leaped off the couch onto the ground and threw me a blanket. Cover your head. As our eyes adjusted to the light, we watched several bats stream out of our fireplace, flying in circles around our heads. We crawled up the stairs and fled into our bedroom, shutting the door behind us. In normal times, we would have pulled out our phones and started frantically searching for what to do when your house is infested with bats. We didn't have that option. It was nearly midnight, too late to call a friend, so we just had to pray that the bats hadn't made it into our bedroom. We covered the baby's crib with a mosquito net and tried to go to sleep. Separating spaces for online work and home life has helped me draw a sharp dividing line between my responsibilities to family and employer. The rise of telecommuting, supercharged by the pandemic, seems to have been a mixed bag, even for employees who enjoy it. Workers have more flexibility, but they are now expected to be reachable beyond work hours. Shopping requires careful planning. Without Amazon, we buy most of our goods in person at stores in town. We still order things online, but we can't do it impulsively, and we buy fewer things as a result. When I was out shopping recently, I called Christine at home to see if she needed anything. Just text me a list, I said, completely forgetting that she literally could not. So we made our list the old-fashioned way. We talked about what we needed, and I wrote it on a piece of paper. I acknowledge the immense privilege of being able to choose to opt out of a service that people rely on to get by in daily life. I also benefit from work that can be done partially on my own schedule and a job that provides parental leave, which was when we made this decision. But now that we have made this change in our lives, I will grieve if we ever have to return to the life we had before. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.